Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal Series, five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Justine. Always so wonderful to be here every Tuesday with all of you, my daughter Rebecca, and all of the listeners. How you doing tonight, Rebecca?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Great. Well, I'm glad that I got a chance last week to enjoy a little winter sports, because I guess they're all over for the winter, huh? What's the weather like up by you?
It's very foggy. We've been having this kind of trend of this dense fog sitting in here instead of the rain coming like it has in years past. It's very dense and foggy.
So it's raining here and melting the snow and melting all the ponds. And yeah, but you still have snow.
We don't have snow anymore. It's just usually we have a lot of rain this time of year, and it's just been... We had some rain last week, but just a lot of fog, and it's been like that. It was like this last year, too, so we'll get weeks of fog, and it's really gray and really stagnant air, you know. It's not the most enjoyable weather.
Right, that's where the disease malaria got its name, was bad air, right? Malaria. Stagnant air. They didn't realize it was mosquitoes. Gary did, but get that same kind of air around those places. Well, enough about our problems. Let's focus in on everybody else's problems. We got any problems tonight?
Yeah, we have quite a few questions, and I just want to remind the listeners at 9 o'clock tonight, Stacey Lyons is going to be joining us.
Sounds like fun.
Yes, all right. So your first question here is, Dear Susan, I am desperate for help in finding a remedy for my vaginal infection. After a visit to two general practitioners and two gynecologists, the latter established the cause of my discharge was due to the Gardnerella virus. The discharge presents as a thick, yellow, gooey, and sticky substance that sometimes gets discharged in a blob and other times just as little as a few traces present on my panty liner. It has a faint, fishy odor. It does not itch nor burn and has no other side effects other than the aforementioned. I have been suffering for 1 year and have been prescribed the following medications without any success. And she lists quite a few medications starting in September 1st of 2013, going all the way to the present.
And you probably can't answer this question for me, but what you read did not include any statements of any kind about pain, and so I was astonished to then be told she was suffering.
Yeah.
Does it say anything about itching, about
pain? It does.
Pain?
It says it does not itch nor burn and has no other side effects other than the discharge and the smell.
So suffering? Desperate suffering? I'm a little taken aback by this, but we don't need to go over all the medications that haven't worked. Is there anything else here?
She ends it saying, the above has had little effect, and I am at my wit's end. I cannot afford going to specialists anymore and am afraid that the infection might cause serious illness in the future. Please help. Much appreciated.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I have down there, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way, my new book, in hand. I have turned to page 124, Bacterial Vaginosis, Gardnerella Vaginalis. And as we remember, I go through each one of the steps. And talk about what happens as we try each one of those steps. And because there are 6 steps, which is a lot of information for people, I add a help box. So, here's our help box, and then I will also go over some things that are in some of the other sections, which I think are very important. Help, bacterial vaginosis, Gardnerella. Expect results in 7 to 10 days. Eat yogurt, plain yogurt, daily, and apply some vaginally. Yogurt that is skim milk yogurt probably contains milk powder, powdered milk, and so is not considered medicinal. Very important to get whole milk yogurt. Whether it's organic or not is not as important as it being whole milk yogurt. So eat some yogurt. That could be as little as 3 tablespoonsful a day or more if you want more, and apply some vaginally. 2, take a dropperful of yarrow tincture twice a day. That's Achillea millifolium. It's a tincture made from the fresh flowering plant. 3, if you can tolerate it, use a garlic suppository. And it refers you to page 148 in the previous chapter, which was the chapter about other vaginal infections, vaginal yeast, and information about how to prepare and use a garlic suppository. If your bacterial vaginosis is chronic, and it sounds like yours is chronic, then you might want to try Mayan abdominal massage. But I do want to say that so far as we know, chronic bacterial vaginosis does not go into pelvic inflammatory disorder, into a scarring of the pelvic organs. It is a somewhat of a problem. The Santa Cruz Women's Health Center says that what they see is that chronic bacterial vaginosis goes along with cervical changes. Now, whether those cervical changes are caused by the constant infection or whether they, in fact, promote the infection, we don't really know at this point. Bacterial vaginosis by itself does not spread. In other words, it doesn't work its way up into the uterus. However, having chronic bacterial vaginosis has been linked to an increased risk of HIV infection and complications during pregnancy. So I would agree with you, excuse me, that you are on the right track in trying to get rid of this. Doctor said that of the three most common vaginal infections, Trichomonas, Candida, and bacterial vaginosis. Bacterial vaginosis, or Gardnerella, is the most prevalent and the most difficult to treat. No matter how it is treated, it tends to come back again and again and again. I hope that you're listening now, and I want to encourage you to stick around for the whole show, or at least come back for the last half hour, because our guest tonight is going to talk about what she does and what she has done in order to create a healthy ecosystem in the vagina. And that's really what we're talking about. Let me see if I can make an analogy here that will help you understand it. It's as though we went into the forest and you said, oh, you know, I really don't like all of these twigs and branches that have fallen down here. They hurt my feet when I walk in the forest. Let's burn them up and get rid of them. And in burning them up to get rid of them, you burn down the trees of the forest. And now you keep getting more little twigs and you're upset, but there's no way to really create a healthy forest until the forest regrows. This is the primary reason for using yogurt, is because it will help the forest regrow that has been mowed down by the drugs that you have taken. It's also quite important to keep vaginal acidity high. Whether or not you are taking drugs, it is one of the most important things for you to do, is to really understand what changes the acid-alkaline balance of the vagina and what you can do to keep it more acidic. You may even want to buy some acidophilus capsules and insert an acidophilus capsule every 12 hours high up in the vagina. This will cause copious amounts of drool. Be sure you're wearing your panty liner, excuse me, if you're going to do this during the day, or you can just do it at night when you're in bed and put a towel under you. You can also put a tablet of ascorbic acid, that would be vitamin C, a 300 milligram tablet of vitamin C, hopefully without flavoring or coloring, inserted vaginally, is an excellent acidity restorer, and this, again, will make your forest regrow. In a way, we can't ever really imagine a vagina without Gardnerella in it. It is that prevalent. It is that common. There is Gardnerella probably in the vaginas of almost every living woman on the planet. But what we want is enough other organisms in there that the Gardnerella is not the primary thing. Even in your discussion of it, although you don't say so, it's very clear from what you're saying that there are times when it waxes and there are times when it wanes. start paying attention to those times. What are you doing, eating, thinking, interacting with at those times? So, again, remember that there are all of these steps that we can use, but I'm going to go right down into some of the step four remedies. And this is my thinking on that. When we have used step five, which is drugs, then we can't just go back to step zero. We have to go back to step four and then back to step three. We actually have to retrace our steps in a way. So a couple of things that we briefly touched on in the help, and that was yarrow tincture. And yarrow has been shown to specifically kill the Gardnerella organism. So you can, in addition to taking it as a tincture internally, you can also use yarrow infusion, and you can make that from the dried yarrow tops by weighing out an ounce, pouring a quart of boiling water over it in a jar, putting a tight lid on the jar, and letting it sit for 4 hours or overnight, and then use that as a sitz bath. In other words, just sit in it. And you want to do that when you're taking the tincture. That's a great idea, but you don't have to. You can use either the yarrow tincture or the yarrow sitz bath, or, of course, you can use both of them. And then bag balm. You used to be able to just go to drugstores and get sulfur ointment, but they don't sell sulfur ointment for human beings anymore. Now they only sell it for cows. So you got to go someplace that sells bag balm, and interestingly enough, a large drugstore probably will have some bag balm because there are people like myself who know the value of sulfur-based ointments. It stinks, just like sulfur, but it really works against hard-to-clear surface bacterial infections like Gardnerella. So get your bag balm and smear it on down there. I hope this helps. Give us a call or write us an email in no less than 2 weeks and tell us what's going on. Because if, after you use these remedies, there is still something going on after 2 weeks, then I believe there might be something further going on. And if at all possible, I would love it if you could call if this is still going on after 2 more weeks. Green blessings.
Okay, we have a caller waiting.
Okay.
In the 631 area code.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello,
what's your name?
Hi, this is Colette,
Hi,
from Long Island. Hi, I'm calling about fibroid tumors. And I had spoken to you a few weeks ago after being admitted into the hospital on November 25th with very heavy vaginal bleeding. It was 2 weeks of vaginal bleeding. They did an abdominal ultrasound and found that I had a very small fibroid tumor, but a large ovarian cyst, 4.1 by 2.5 centimeters. You had recommended for the cyst to start taking chickweed tincture, which I did immediately. I told my regular doctor about this because we were waiting for an appointment for a gynecologist. My health insurance doesn't have any gynecologists on the east end of Long Island, and I had a 3-month wait to the end of January. The doctor decided on December 28th to do a follow-up ultrasound in his office, and that result showed no cyst, but that the fibroid had more than doubled in size with numerous other lesions. I complained to the insurance, and they allowed me to see an out-of-network gynecologist last week. She did a pap smear. I'm waiting for the results, but her feeling on the size of the fibroid growth within a month, was that possibly the cyst was pumping out so much estrogen that it caused this fibroid's growth to just explode. I will be seeing her tomorrow to have a transvaginal ultrasound. So I was wondering, what can I do to support my body's healing and shrinking the fibroids? And on a second note, my regular doctor, my PC, is so impressed with the absolute disappearance of the cyst. I had given her a copy of Healing Wise and Down There, and she is recommending many of her patients to read your book.
Well, first of all, Colette, I really want to thank you for calling in and for helping us follow along and have a sense of what's going on with you. I really appreciate that very much. And
thank you.
Certainly, I always feel like a child, you know, clapping my hands with glee. Oh, goody, goody, chickweed worked again. And it does. It does. It works wonderfully. It works wonderfully for a great many women. So I'm so happy that it worked for you.
I'm very grateful.
Yeah. So have you read the section on fibroids in Down There?
Yes, and I did order the Vitex from Red Moon Herbals.
Okay. So that's the first thing in the help box, is to start taking a dropper full of Vitex or soft palmetto tincture 2 to 4 times a day. And I certainly understand that your insurance is not going to cover acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that, if there is someone in your area who is a what I would call a serious acupuncturist, even in a few sessions, you could get a real change in how the energy is. Just for the people who are listening, and you've already read this, let me remind us all that fibroids are incredibly common. By the age of 50, more than 80% of black women and 70% of white women have fibroids in their uterus. So fibroids certainly can be a problem, and they can be a problem if they cause heavy bleeding. They can be a problem if they cause pain or if they cause pressure on the bladder or the rectum. But in general, the fact that one has fibroids is not a problem. Fibroids can grow rapidly or slowly, and whether they grow rapidly or slowly is meaningless. There is no way to predict if or how fast a fibroid will grow, and surgery to remove a fibroid or the uterus because it's growing fast or before it gets too big is, by the medical profession, considered bad advice. That isn't to say that they don't give this bad advice. Nonetheless, it is considered bad advice. It can be scary to think, oh my goodness, there's a fibroid in my uterus and it's growing and it's doubled in size. But what I'm saying is I do not think it truly is cause for alarm.
All right.
Uterine fibroids can shrink spontaneously. And what encourages fibroid growth is progesterone, not estrogen.
All right.
So far as I know, cysts don't usually produce hormones. And so whether or not there was a cyst in your ovary probably wouldn't have changed the amount of any kind of hormone that you were making.
Okay.
Again, fibroids shrink, fibroids grow. We have not, and believe me, there's a lot of people looking into this. We're talking about, you know, the huge numbers of women
mm-hmm.
with fibroids, some of whom are bothered. And we have not been able to pin it on anything. And I'm talking about the medical establishment as well as alternative medicine. All right. Lori Hudson, a wonderful naturopathic doctor who specializes in working with reproductive issues, says of all the things that she helps women with, the one where she tells the woman beforehand we have may have no success at all is fibroids. So I always say to the woman, be sure that you really want to get rid of the fibroid before you engage yourself in doing that. I, on purpose, actually do my best to forget the facts and details about the people that I talk to, so I don't remember how old you are.
I'm 51, just turned 51.
So, has it been more than 5 years since your last period?
No, I have been having very light periods for the past 9 months, and then starting in November, on November 11th, it started as a normal but a heavy period, and it didn't stop, and by the 12th or 13th day, it was almost like I was hemorrhaging.
Yes, exactly. And during that time when you were bleeding, what were you doing to stop the bleeding?
I wasn't doing anything to stop the bleeding.
Okay. Well, see, this to me is more important than any discussion about the fibroid. Because this, correct me if I'm wrong, this is what's scary. Is this all this bleeding, right?
Yeah.
Right? So fibroid, no fibroid, fairy godmother, no fairy godmother. It's the bleeding that we really need to focus in on.
Yeah.
So in my menopause book and in Down There, I talk about heavy bleeding and what to do.
I did order and start taking the green pastures fermented cod liver oil, and by the fourth day of taking it, first day the bleeding diminished by a third. The second day, and I was only taking 2 tablespoons, one in the morning, one at night, but by the fourth day, this bleeding stopped to just lightly staining or spotting. And then that was for a week, and then I haven't bled in 15 days.
Good. All right. So this is what I think, is that so long as you feel safe and confident that you have a remedy that's going to take care of you if you start bleeding heavily again, that the fibroids is not an issue in and of itself.
All right.
And I think that you have, with the help of chickweed, gotten rid of an ovarian cyst. Am I wrong?
It looks like it.
Well, then, if you want to get rid of the fibroid, get rid of the fibroid. I mean, since the fibroids, as they are, come and go, and this one seems to be getting bigger, just tell it to turn around and get smaller.
Mm-hmm. I'm also eating natto. 3 times a week.
Brave woman. Oh, brave.
No, it's not that bad if you put it in miso. It's actually okay in miso. If you like the consistency of a head cold.
Right. Black slime. Oh, it's just so not American. What can we say? I also must say that I am a devotee of Shepherd's Purse. And I really like women who have heavy bleeding to have a bottle of Shepherd's Purse on hand.
All right. I do have high blood pressure issues.
We're talking about taking maybe 4 dropperfuls of Shepherd's Purse tincture, and I have never heard of Shepherd's Purse having any effect on blood pressure. Have you?
An old medical herbal. had something to say about it, but this one was dated like 1920s. It was a part of my grandfather's collection.
We're not talking about you taking shepherd's purse on a daily basis. We're talking about your having it on hand, so that if you start bleeding, then and in fact, we might say that if you're bleeding, you need to raise your blood pressure, right?
That's very interesting. You know, that's very interesting. When I went to have my blood pressure taken last, it was 118 over 58.
There you go.
Really interesting. I'm like, wow, great blood pressure, but I'm bleeding.
Exactly. You don't have enough pressure to keep the blood inside.
I think the other aspect, and maybe this is something to address at another time, is the psycho-emotional connection to fibroids.
Yes.
Since I've been living in a non-sexual but family relationship with my partner, who got sick many years ago from contracting Legionnaire's disease, and the fetus has had a hard time with circulation and things like that. And wanting to keep the family together, I'm willing to make that, or I have been willing to make that sacrifice of not having an intimate relationship. But there are times I have resentment about it. And I'm gonna own that. I think a part of this focus on my uterus is because I haven't been paying attention in a positive way. I haven't been nurturing that part of myself.
I don't need to tell you what to do. Right, and even if it's just putting your hand on your uterus before you go to sleep at night and saying, I love you, I'll take care of you. Simple thing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I do want to say before I go that my doctor, my regular doctor, my PC, is so impressed with everything I've shared with her. I gave her a copy of Green Blessings and Down There. She is recommending your book to her patients, and she's even recommending at least two of her patients to contact you directly, which I think is astounding. I think it's amazing.
Herbal medicine is people's medicine. It's not going to help everybody every single time, but how wonderful that we can use it to avoid the use of drugs and surgery, which are lifesavers when they're needed, but they're being overused.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that no one more than doctors understands that. Every medical professional I've talked to very much understands that surgery and drugs are overused. But to them, they can't quite tell what of the alternative and complementary therapies really work and when. It's a huge thicket of information. And one of the things that I find that healthcare professionals like is that my books include their options as well as what I might call my options, so that it is true complementary medicine, all of the options laid out for us so that we can choose the simplest, safest, and most effective ones and yet have access to the stronger ones when we need them.
Well, thank you for serving all of these people and all these women and giving this so real and practical suggestions that work, that I found, and maybe not work for everyone, and maybe it's the path of finding the right one that works for you. But I'm so grateful that you've spent your life putting this information in an accessible way. It's very meaningful to me. And I appreciate it, like I can't express. But
thank you very much. Green blessing.
Every blessing.
Okay.
Well, that makes you smile, doesn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We do have another caller waiting on here, so I'm going to open up the line to the 732 area code.
Hello.
They're not quite on yet. For some reason, it's not switching over. Here we go.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. My name's Angel. I have something on a slightly different topic that I had wanted to ask. I'm trying to help. Your mention of sulfur reminded me of it. I'm trying to help a boy who's about and he has scabies, and the mother has been using essential oils with him, which just kind of, because of things that you've said, makes me go, okay, yes, they technically work, but I don't know if they're the best option. And I had actually been looking for a sulfur ointment and found a 10% sulfur ointment on Amazon, and I didn't know if that would be a good thing to suggest or if there was something else that you might know of to suggest to her to use with her son.
Well, I certainly agree with you that essential oils are not inherently safer or kinder than any kind of medicine that we could get at the drugstore to deal with scabies. Scabies is a tiny little organism that crawls under the skin. Those are called 7-year itch. And it's pretty easily passed by sleeping in sheets. If somebody's had scabies, or using a towel that somebody who has scabies has used, generally starts in the webbing between the fingers or the toes and works its way up to the core of the body, settling in under the armpits and through the chest and the back area. So you can kind of tell how long somebody has had scabies by how far up toward the core of their body it has progressed, because they literally eat their way toward the core of your body. They burrow and dig a tunnel underneath your skin, and they defecate in that tunnel, and that sets up an immune response which causes an itch. And of course, where you are itching is where they are not anymore, right?
Right.
It's where they've left behind is where you itch. So, and they're actually too deep to just itch. It's not like you could itch them out. So with the sulfur ointment, usually it's a two-step process of getting in a very hot bath. And I like for people to use a soap, an alcohol-based soap. There's quite a few alcohol-based soap out now. But green soap is one that I've used.
And okay, we actually have that around.
Yeah, a hot bath with some green soap, and then the sulfur ointment on immediately. The hot bath and the green soap open up the pores, and then you get the sulfur ointment on there, and it literally kills the scabies. They cannot breathe. Mm-hmm. It's like shoving sulfur up into their tunnels. So, hey, 10% sulfur ointment sounds good to me.
Okay.
I don't see any problem with it, except that some people are sensitive to sulfur. Some people could get a skin reaction to the sulfur, or could feel woozy from sulfur. I think it's one of the reasons that sulfur ointments are not so easy to get anymore.
Yes.
How old is the boy we're talking about here?
He's 6.
Okay, so we're not talking about something under the age of 3 here.
Right. One of the things that I wanted to note is the mom has multiple chemical sensitivity, which is why she didn't want to use it's more or less an insecticide to put on your skin with
the
her son.
The essential oils are far worse for people with multiple chemical sensitivities than the insecticide.
Okay. Okay, I'll make sure to let her know that. So,
the essential oils.
I care so much because my kids play with them, and so I'm like, I want to let them play, but they can't.
Well, I don't think that scabies can be passed by playing. I'm not sure.
Oh, they're running and jumping, and they're little kids. They're tackling each other and rolling around, and so
okay,
that would be the same as sharing sheets and stuff.
Well, no,
anyway, you were about
the thing about the sheets and the towels is that there's some, you know, some long contact, but I understand, and I certainly want to respect whatever you feel you need to do, because it's not fun to have scabies.
Right,
for anybody
right.
at all. And certainly as parents, what we want to do is protect our children. So, yeah, you know, many people somehow think that essential oils are natural. And one of the ways that I found that helps people understand is that I explain to them that essential oils are extracted from plants. And then they are concentrated. And then they are purified. And that these three steps, extraction, concentration, and purification, are the same steps we use whenever we wish to make a drug from a plant. And that essential oils are drugs. And that because they are drugs that contain a great variety of molecules, they're far more likely to trigger sensitivity in someone who is multiply chemically sensitive than a simple insecticide, which is molecularly pure.
Okay.
You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I completely follow you. I guess it would leave me with two questions. One, when you're reading about something and it suggests to use essential oils, how would you figure out what a good alternative is? And are there times that are appropriate to be using essential oils?
I work with the six steps of healing, or the seven medicines. And the seven medicines are serenity medicine, story medicine, energy medicine, lifestyle medicine, alternative medicine, pharmaceutical medicine, and high-tech medicine. Essential oils are pharmaceutical medicine. So then you could say, is there an alternative medicine I could use instead? Is there a lifestyle medicine I could use instead? Is there an energy medicine I could use instead? That's working our way back through the medicines because they are in order of harm. In other words, serenity medicine, story medicine, energy medicine, and lifestyle medicine don't harm. They actually create health. But alternative medicine, pharmaceutical medicine, and high-tech medicine always harm, even if it's only a little bit.
So, in
most cases, I would prefer to use a drug rather than an essential oil.
Interesting. Okay.
Because, as I said, the drug is one molecule. It's been created to do one thing, whereas the essential oil is a drug, but it's a drug that isn't as refined as other drugs. But there's a lot of things working together in it.
Okay.
And, you know, certainly there are side effects from using any drug. There are severe side effects from using essential oils, including disruption of hormones and disruption of the immune system.
It definitely makes sense, but I am going to have to go back and probably replay and pick up on other things that you're saying.
Exactly, so, and to be able to explain it to someone else. I quite
understand. Right, exactly.
It is all being recorded, so you'll be able to do that.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
So you're suggesting an alcohol soap and a hot bath, and then followed by the sulfur lotion. I'd also noticed they had sulfur soap. You wouldn't suggest using that. You'd suggest using the alcohol soap.
That's what I have done.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much.
Being a human being, I tend to repeat what I've done that's been successful.
Yes.
But you could create something on your own, and it could be very successful too.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. You're so welcome. Great blessing. Good night.
All right. We'll go back to some email questions.
All right.
I am a almost 51-year-old man. The medical profession thinks I need to have a colonoscopy, and I recall that you have an opinion about the procedure. I would like to hear your thoughts about this. I know that you are very generous with your knowledge, but I also expect to pay you for your advice to me. Thank you.
Well, you know, I always figure that the payment that people are making is that you're allowing others to listen to our conversation, that rather than this being a private thing, it's blog talk. That means it's being recorded, it's out there, it's available. So as far as I'm concerned, that's the payment that you're making. You're making the payment to the greater common good. You're making the payment to my vision of herbal medicine as people's medicine. And for it to be people's medicine, it needs to be accessible to people. People need to be able to listen in. And this is a great question because, hey, you're not the only 51-year-old out there whose doctor is saying, have a colonoscopy. But I'd actually like to take it one step back before that. What are you doing at the doctor? Do you know that there is no medical group of any kind that recommends a yearly checkup? Do you know that study after study has found that the fewer times that people go to the doctor, the longer they generally live? Now, I know that modern medicine likes to say, wow, you need all of these so-called preventative tests. But, of course, the tests are not preventative at all. So what do we mean by a colonoscopy? Well, we could say very simply, all we're going to do is we're going to put something up your butt, and we're going to look in your colon, and we're going to see if it's healthy. But wait a second, how are we going to do that? Oh, we have to prepare your colon, and that means that you have to take some pretty heavy-duty things that basically wash everything out of your colon. Now, interestingly enough, everyone pretty much agrees that the bacteria in our gut is responsible for our health in a great many ways. It's responsible for our physical health, our mental health. We could say it's responsible for our psycho-spiritual health as well. And yet, here we are telling you that you need to take heavy-duty medicines that will basically wipe out all of the bacteria in your colon. Why? So that we can look up there and see whether or not you have colon cancer, which could be, we don't know, might be caused by lack of bacteria in your colon. This is one of those things where I must admit that I think to myself, have they really thought this through? Have they really thought through all the implications of it? And no, I don't really think they have. I really think that they've thought about it from the other end. They've said, wow, people die of colon cancer, and it's just awful having people die of colon cancer, and we hate to see people die of colon cancer. And I hate it too. My mom died of colon cancer, very progressed colon cancer. And so how could we stop so many people from dying of colon cancer? Well, we know that if they ate better diets, there would be less colon cancer, but we can't get them to change their diets. So I guess what we should do instead is we should look up there and see if we can see these polyps that tend to develop before the colon cancer develops. And then if we do see them, we could surgically remove them, and we could reduce people's risk of colon cancer in that way. And all of that's true. All of that is completely true. But you see, it's looking at it from a different way than what I'm looking at it. It's looking at it from the viewpoint of someone who wants to prevent colon cancer, this disease, and these people who get it who aren't willing to change and aren't willing to help themselves. And so we are then kind of given carte blanche as the helpers to, in fact, ruin your health while we're attempting to help you. Of course, I'm exaggerating here when I'm saying ruin your health. I don't really know that using these heavy-duty preparation drugs to prepare your colon, and it looks beautiful and pink and obviously empty and void of anything. I don't really know what the consequence of that would be, but I will tell you that it's enough for me to not go there. I am willing to eat lots more fiber in my diet. I'm willing to eat lots of fruits and vegetables. I'm willing to eat whole grains. I'm willing to eat cooked greens. I'm willing to do the things that make my colon healthy. If you are, then you could simply say to your doctor, thanks so much. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's very useful for people who are not proactive with their health. But for me, I'm going to be doing the things that promote health in my colon, and therefore I'm not going to have a colonoscopy. If that's what you want to say, you're certainly welcome to say it. Green blessing.
Okay, let's move on to the next question. I am hoping you will clear up my confusion surrounding red clover. I have taken in conflicting information, and now I'm just confused. In several articles, I've read that you let your red clover steep overnight, but I also read that red clover releases toxins after 4 hours. And I heard elsewhere that if you dry red clover improperly, it can grow a toxic fungus. This makes me nervous about infusing it at all. Finally, I am wondering what to do with red clover I currently have from Star West Botanicals. It contains the blossom, leaves, and stems. Oops. The blossoms are a bit browner than I would prefer. I'm trying to decide if I should just use the tea or potentially return it to the earth. Does red clover offer anything when the blossoms are too brown? Thank you.
All right, let's deal with one of the easiest of the many questions of this question first. Any herb improperly dried is going to grow mold. Any herb at all improperly dried. So what does it mean to be properly dried? You can go to YouTube and you can see videos of me and my students laying red clover out on screens or a basket individually so that the blossoms do not touch each other and they dry beautifully and with all of their color intact. However, let's face it, that red clover has a lot of effort put into it. There's a wonderful person who harvests red clover individually, grows it organically, harvests the blossoms individually, lays them out individually. And the last that I heard, that person was charging $60 or $65 a pound for red clover. Well, they put that much work and energy into it. Mm. So if we're going to make red clover at a, say, commercially reasonable price, like $25 to $30 a pound, then we're probably not going to be able to lay the blossoms out one by one so that they don't touch, and they're going to touch, and they're going to turn brown. That brown does not indicate a mold. It's a reaction, just like the difference between green tea and black tea. The green tea is tea that is dried very rapidly. And the darker the tea is, the longer it is allowed to be damp while it is drying. As a matter of fact, some of the very, very dark teas actually do grow a certain kind of mold that is very valued by tea connoisseurs and is said to create a large number of unique antioxidants in those very fermented tea blends. So the possibility of there being a terrible mold in any kind of herb is the possibility of there being a terrible mold in any kind of dried food. We need to take good care if we're drying it ourselves, and we need to look and smell when we are purchasing herbs. So the red clover that you have is brown because of how it was dried, but it doesn't mean that it's moldy. Usually when something is moldy, it smells moldy. And if you open the bag and shake the bag or put your hand in the bag and stir the herb, kind of smoke comes out of it, which are actually the mold spores there. And in that situation, I certainly give that herb back to the earth. But if the red clover blossoms are just brown, it's not a problem. I made red clover infusion the other day from some red clover and remarked as I was making it, whoa, these blossoms are really brown. But it's okay. Maybe if I was using that red clover because I wanted to get pregnant or because I had a cancer diagnosis, I wouldn't be so cavalier about it, and I would be willing to pay more for the specially harvested red clover. But since I'm using it as part of my round of infusions and using it as a preventative, I'm willing to accept quality that is a little bit less than what I might want if I had a specific goal for using the red clover. The red clover infusion was delicious, even though the blossoms themselves were, in fact, completely brown. The little bit of leaf that was in it was still bright green, and that, again, indicated to me there was no mold, as well as my nose and my eye. I have never in my life heard of any toxin that red clover can produce by long steeping. I'm sorry. I just don't know where on earth that information came from. If you want to let us know where you found it so that we can get in touch with those people and tell them that so far as we know, they are wrong, wrong, wrong. I can only say to you that I have been drinking red clover infusion, generally steeped for 8 to 10 hours for over 25 years. And if there was some toxin that it produced, I would suspect that I long ago would have been dead from that. So let's just say that there isn't any toxin at all. I agree with you, though. There's a lot of confusing information about red clover out there. And perhaps part of that is that often people just say red clover and they don't say whether it was a tea or an infusion or a tincture or a capsule or really, in fact, what they were doing. To summarize, you have some red clover you got from Pacific Botanicals, a great supplier of herb. It's a little brown. That happens. The way it's being dried, because we need to bulk it up, shouldn't be a problem. Go ahead and make infusion with it. Let that infusion steep for at least 4 hours or longer. I let mine steep overnight. There is no toxin that is going to be produced by the red clover. I like to put a tiny pinch of mint in my red clover when I brew it, but that's because I don't like the taste of black tea, and red clover tastes a lot like black tea. It's got those tannins in it. So especially if the blossoms are brown, it's going to taste more like black tea than like green tea. Was there any other part of that question that I didn't answer, Rebecca? Did I get all of the parts of it?
I think you got all of it. She was wondering what she could do with the red clover that has the blossom leaves and stems.
It's hard for me to know how much green there is. I would say that usually the red clover that I want to use for infusion, I don't want it to be any more than 10% green. So if it is more than that and she wants to sit there while she's talking to a friend and pick up the blossoms with a little bit of green and use those for infusions and then do something else with the green part, which could be to add it to her compost pile, that's certainly something she could do with that. And I was a little confused as to whether that was the same stuff that had the brown blossoms.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it seems to me. Okay, I think that's it, though.
All right. Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. So next question. Hi, I'm totally new to herbs. My question is, I'm hypothyroid and have endometriosis. We are currently trying to conceive our second child after an early loss in April. What herbs would aid in fertility and healing and also be safe for my conditions? I've read about red raspberry leaf, nettles, red clover blossom, and Vitex. Any insight? When my first was conceived, I was healthy and did not have these problems. C-section caused endo. I'm 30 years old and really wanting to conceive ASAP. Thank you.
Okay. I do not think that there's any problem at all with any of the herbs that you have mentioned. And those should be just fine. I guess that I would have to differ with you about the cesarean section causing endometriosis. Not from what I know about endometriosis. And certainly, given the huge number of cesarean sections that are being done, if a cesarean section caused endometriosis, we would see a lot more of it. So my best guess would be that there was some endometriosis present, and that was then seen during the cesarean section, so you became more aware of it at that time. I'm glad that you're not blaming the cesarean section for your thyroid issues there. But again, I don't think that any of the herbs that you have mentioned would be a difficulty given either the diagnosis of endometriosis or thyroid difficulties. We certainly do know that foods affect endometriosis. Eating red meat on a daily basis doubles your difficulties with endometriosis. So if you haven't already, you might want to switch to a lower meat diet. 2 servings of fruit a day reduces difficulty with endometriosis in about 40% of women, and 2 servings of greens daily also reduces difficulty, but that's in about 70% of women. Look at the fats in your diet. The fats in your diet are probably going to make the biggest difference in what's going on with your endometriosis. Especially look toward getting a lot more omega-3 fatty acids. Those will come directly from fish. As you eat less meat, I hope you'll be eating more fish, small fish like sardines, herring, anchovies, as well as larger fish like trout and salmon are some of the very best sources of those omega-3 fatty acids. So stinging nettle infusion would be great. Red raspberry infusion would be great. Red clover infusion, of course, is my big pick for women who want to increase fertility. Is about 2 quarts of red clover infusion every week. Certainly no need to be taking it all of the time. There are a great many herbalists who think that both infertility issues and endometrial issues have something to do with the liver. So you might want to ask yourself, is my liver being stressed? What can I do to make my liver be calmer? And what kind of herbs could I take that are helpful for my liver? And good luck to you in your quest for a baby. Green blessings.
Okay, next email question. As a soon-to-be 65-year-old woman, I have been told by my naturopath that I need more fat in my diet. I am thin and would like advice how to add more to my diet. My hair, skin, etc. is too dry. I feel like I live in a desert. Thank you. Your response is appreciated.
I very much like to see animal fat in women's diets. And that animal fat does not have to come directly from animals, but certainly that's one direct way that we can get it. Animal fat can come into our diet in the form of, as we said, eating animals directly. That would be meat. And, of course, fish. Fish include animal fats as well. But we can also get it more indirectly by eating eggs or dairy products, including full-fat yogurt, full-fat cheese, and full-fat milk. It can sometimes be hard to find full-fat products, but keep looking for them, and I think that dairy products is one place where it's really worthwhile getting organic. So could start out in the morning by having some full-fat yogurt, and if you want to, stirring a little frozen fruit into that, and a couple of pieces of whole grain bread with some butter on them. Now we have gotten good quality animal fat from both the full fat yogurt and from the butter. For lunch, we might want to have a salad. And that salad could include some full fat organic cheese, as well as perhaps some little fishes, sardines or anchovies, very lovely, in salad. We'll also use some full-fat salad dressing. If we're buying a pre-made salad dressing or if we're making our own, we're going to be using olive oil, extra virgin olive oil on our salad. It's not an animal fat, but it's certainly one of the fats known worldwide to help improve the health of the hair and the skin. As a matter of fact, while you're pouring that olive oil on your salad, you might want to rub some into your skin and into your hair as well. I was told by a man once who lived on a very small island off the coast of Greece that there was a child born in his community who had a birth defect that prevented the child from nursing. I'm going to guess that that was a cleft palate, and that there was an operation that could be done for the child, but all the people on the island had to get together in order to get the money for the operation and get this child to the mainland, and it couldn't happen instantly. So they kept the child alive by rubbing olive oil into its skin, extra virgin olive oil into its skin, on an hourly basis for the week it took them to get it together to get the child to a hospital. Olive oil feeds the skin. Olive oil feeds the hair. And then, of course, in the evening, whatever cooked vegetables you have, that's another great place to use some butter or some olive oil, or you might want to consider a little bit of coconut fat. Coconut fat, again, is a wonderful, healthy fat. Sally Fallon has a wonderful book out on coconut, you may be interested in looking at that, or some bacon fat. I don't eat a lot of bacon because it is a processed meat, and of all the meats, the processed meats are the most problematic of them. But, of course, like all human beings, I love bacon. And I'm really glad to hear in some of the more elite cardiac circles that people are actually coming around to a way of thinking that bacon fat actually might be healthy for the heart. Now, again, we're not talking about having bacon for breakfast and cooking all your food in bacon fat. Certainly you saw a lot of that down south. We're talking about using it occasionally as a fat. I hope this has been some help to you. It was kind of a general question, and I've given you perhaps a more specific answer than you were looking for. I do wish you green blessings.
Okay, next question. Dear Susan, I have been diagnosed with osteoporosis and have been reading about natural ways to improve my bone health. I've noticed that you recommend several herbal infusions, but I can't tell if one is better than the other. I have no experience with herb and infusion, so I need some help here if I want to try to improve my health naturally. A little about me. 55 years old, about 10 pounds overweight. I don't eat fowl, beef, lamb, but I do eat fish and seafood. I have a healthy diet, and I exercise regularly. Weightlifting and biking, swimming, elliptical. I have hypothyroidism and recently had my first kidney stone, so lifestyle modification changes need to consider the risk for development kidney stones. Right now, my plan is to A, lose weight, B, increase intake of cooked green leafy vegetables, 4 to 5 servings a week, C, reduce coffee intake from 3 to 2 cups per day, D, reduce caffeine by changing my regular coffee to half-calf. E, increase pounding activity by doing 100 jumping jacks daily. The missing piece is any supplements, natural or pill form. Thanks in advance for any advice you can provide.
I don't agree with anything at all on your plan. Uh-oh. So what should I do here? Should I just say good luck and go ahead and do it, or should we actually talk about what's going on here? We're in a situation where a lot of women are being diagnosed with osteoporosis who truly do not have a problem. Also, And let me tell you that osteoporosis itself is not a problem, nor does it inevitably lead to broken bones, nor does the treatment of osteoporosis prevent broken bones. So, in a way, we need to understand that the fact that you have a diagnosis is meaningless. You're a healthy woman. You're a healthy woman. You're a vigorous woman. You eat well. I'd like to see some meat in your diet, but that's a whole other issue there. The only thing on your plan that I would agree with is increasing the amount of cooked leafy greens that you have in your diet. And I would urge you to cook those leafy greens for at least an hour before you eat them. I do not think that reducing your caffeine intake by having half caffeine or by drinking two cups of coffee instead of three is meaningful at all in terms of your osteoporosis. If it's something that you want to do, you certainly can do it. I don't think it's a problem, but neither is it a problem to drink three cups of coffee a day. That's really within the limits of good health. It does mean that you're addicted, but, you know, reducing the amount of caffeine or coming down from three cups to two cups is not going to change that addiction. If you want to not be addicted to caffeine, then you have to stop drinking coffee altogether and drink tea. Yes, there's some caffeine in tea, but it doesn't addict people the way the caffeine in coffee seems to addict people. So that would be my sense is, you know, either just keep drinking coffee the way you're drinking coffee, which is fine, or switch over to tea and get off the coffee altogether at this point. The very first thing that you want to do is the worst possible thing you can do. Do not lose weight. Don't lose weight. Can you hear me? Hello, hello, hello. I don't care if you're 10 pounds overweight, and I doubt that you are 10 pounds overweight. You know, body mass index. We're told we're supposed to have a body mass index of 25, and that that's healthy, and that anything over that is overweight. Well, you know what? I don't agree with that at all, and neither do these statistics. When we actually look, what we find is that women who have a body mass index of 26, 27, and even 28 are in general healthier, have less chronic disease, less acute disease, and recover more quickly than women who are at a body mass index of 23, 24, or 25. Don't lose weight. Most of the time, when women attempt to lose weight, what they do is they lose bone mass. Don't lose weight. Don't go on a diet. If you want to, eat fewer calorie-rich things. That might take off, say, a pound a month. That might be a reasonable goal, but don't lose weight. You need that weight. Think about it. The bones get massive to support weight. You're going to do jumping jacks, but lose weight doesn't make sense. I personally think that doing jumping jacks is craziness. It's certainly not a way that I can think of to build bone mass. It's high impact, and it's really hard on your joints. I would far rather see you walk. What's your daily walk goal? My daily walk goal is 3 miles. I don't make it every single day, but most days I walk 3 miles. And you know what? I'll be able to keep walking 3 miles for decades, because at 60, oh my goodness, what, in a couple of weeks I'm going to be 68. At 68, I still have decades to live. I'm not going to be doing jumping jacks every day for decades, but I could be walking 3 miles every day for decades. Don't make short-term changes that drop you off at the end no better than they were when you jumped on. If you're going to make a change, make that change for the long haul. What kind of thing can you do now that you can still be doing when you're 90? That's what we want to know. And to answer your last question directly, no supplements, no supplements of any kind. Of course, you're going to be drinking nourishing herbal infusions, but it doesn't really matter which one. That's why I rotate through them, because each one offers me its own unique benefit. I use stinging nettle one day, oat straw the next day, red clover, comfrey leaf, linden. I have 5 herbs that I rotate through, and they are all wonderful to help build bone mass. the things that would be on my little list for any woman who wanted to improve the health of her bones would be, item number one, drink at least 4 quarts of nourishing herbal infusion on a daily basis, and that would be nettle, oat straw, red clover, or comfrey. If you want to drink more than that, then do include a quart of linden, which is anti-inflammatory and can definitely help. Two, eat yogurt on a daily basis. Or if you can't eat yogurt every day, be sure that you eat at least a quart of full-fat yogurt every week. Item number three, cut down on or eliminate the number of foods in your diet that contain soy. Miso is certainly fine, and tamari is certainly fine. Wonderful foods. And if there's a little bit of soy lecithin in your chocolate, no big deal. But steer clear of other soy products because they are real bone destroyers. Did you know that women who took calcium supplements were twice as likely to break a bone? It's true. They have denser bones, but those bones are more brittle. So let me circle around to where I started out with you here. Osteoporosis is not a problem. Osteoporosis does not lead to broken bones, but taking calcium supplements does lead to broken bones. What you want is to have flexible, healthy bones. They may not be as dense as what the medical profession would like to see, but they can be flexible and carry you on for many, many decades without breakage. Green blessing.
All right. Next question. Can caring for my elderly father who passed away this week bring on an early menopause? I have missed my period this month and have been having night sweats and some hot flashes during the day for the first time in my life. Can I settle down and go back to a normal cycle with herbs, yoga, and stress management? It feels so hard to lose my dad and my period at the same time. Thanks for answering.
And she's not going to tell us how old she is, huh?
No, she does not say.
Right again. I don't know what you're talking about, premature. There's no way for me to answer your question. I'm sorry. Please, if you want to use a word like premature, you need to give me a little factual data. Are you 24 years old? Are you 34 years old? Are you 44 years old? Are you 54 years old? Makes a big difference. Right again. Thank you.
Okay. Next question. Greetings. I desperately need an advice. I have an autoimmune disorder, and so far nothing has worked except SEAC tonic. I just started taking them a few days ago, and my symptoms are finally getting better. However, I'm still night nursing a 2.5-year-old, and I read that Chinese rhubarb, one of the ingredients, others are burdock root, slippery elm, inner bark, sheep sorrel, shouldn't be taken while breastfeeding. I really want to continue taking these herbs, otherwise I won't be able to function. Is Chinese rhubarb safe while breastfeeding a toddler? Thank you very much in advance.
What you are doing is not safe. If you want to continue to take SEAC, you should not breastfeed your child. Green blessing.
Okay.
To be more specific, rhubarb is a cathartic. It causes massive disruption to the bowels, and it can cause diarrhea in a child, which could ultimately kill the child. We're talking not safe here. Not safe. Don't do it.
Would you suggest that she maybe write back or call in, and if she wants some other recommendations for her autoimmune disorder?
No, she sounds pretty set on SEAC.
Okay.
It's very clear from what she says. It's the only thing that's worked. She wants to keep taking it. Time to wean her child.
Okay. Next question. I have a question. I have anxiety disorder. I started using St. John's wort, and it's good stuff. It helps with my anxiety. I have stopped taking Zoloft in favor of St. John's wort. Now I want to stop using Xanax. What herb can I take that has the same effects as Xanax? Xanax is the only drug that actually helps slow down or stop my manic or my panic attacks short term. I need a replacement herb. Can you help me, please, Susan?
There's a couple of possibilities. Motherwort tincture, taken right at the time when you're starting to panic, can act very, very quickly. Hops, used as a tea or a tincture, is also considered to be a substitute for Xanax. The difficulty with hops is that it doesn't act as quickly as motherwort, and hops is more likely to make you very sleepy. Let us know if one of these works for you. Green Pussy.
The next question is similar. It says, I recently found out I suffer from ADD, and I was wondering if you knew of any alternatives to medication a doctor would prescribe me. Thanks so much in advance.
I tend not to use plants as fake drugs. So I answered the previous question about what herb could I use instead of Xanax in a rather lighthearted manner. But here, the second time, I'm being asked to simply make a switch between a drug and an herb. I'm going to dig in my heels and say, no, it doesn't work that way. That's not what happens. Drugs and herbs are different. A drug, as we've been talking about tonight, is a single purified molecule with a direction of action. An herb is a collection of complementary molecules which have a global direction of action. So if I say that hawthorn can moderate blood pressure, hawthorn can literally raise low blood pressure or bring down high blood pressure. But if I give you a blood pressure medication, it will only bring down blood pressure. Drugs have a direction of action. Herbs don't. So we don't really use an herb instead of a drug. And this already, this thinking in this different way, then encourages us to go back to the beginning, to serenity medicine. And to start saying, what am I doing here with serenity medicine? And then what is my story? What story medicine am I engaging? What energy medicine am I using? What lifestyle medicine am I using? Now, if we have already done surgery or drugs and we have to go back through the steps, that would then lead one to think that the herb is somehow replacing the drug, because we would move from pharmaceutical medicine to alternative medicine or to herbal medicine, as it were. And we would stop taking the drug. We would start taking the herb. But it's not a replacement at all. And in many instances, we simply don't need to take a drug at all. Certainly in what you're talking about here, you have been diagnosed. What caused this diagnosis? Did you say that you were having difficulty? Were you having difficulty focusing? One of the great focusing herbs is coffee. As a matter of fact, if you don't get addicted to coffee, coffee is one of the very best herbs for focusing and helping yourself. Remember that. This is one of the reasons why college students can use coffee so successfully. When they're cramming, get a lot of information in their head. It doesn't really aid long-term memory, but it's excellent for short-term memory and for focusing in on things. Or is this a diagnosis that has come because you have chosen to try to make your career in a way that is at odds with your, shall we poetically call it, your innermost soul, which likes change and variety and excitement and does not want to be sitting in a cubicle somewhere? So then we might want to ask ourselves, is your career so important that we're going to have to drug you in order for you to pursue it, or is it time for you to make a different choice? Now, again, you haven't given me very much information here. I'm guessing, going out on a limb, maybe it's not even that at all. And so let me end with talking about catnip tincture. The tincture made from the fresh flowering tops of catnip, and must be fresh, can't be from the dried catnip, has seemed to the parents that I have talked to be useful for them in helping their children who have an inability to focus and to calm down. Who knows? Perhaps it could be helpful for you too, but do think about the other things that I've mentioned. I hope that if you are not bothered by what is going on with you, that you understand that there is nothing that you have to do. You don't have to change yourself to make yourself fit into life. You need to change your life so that your life fits around you. Like in the story of the Cinderella, right? The stepsisters try to cut their feet. Oh, yes, it's not the Walt Disney version, but the original Grimm's version. They come with a glass slipper, and the first sister comes down, and she can't quite fit her foot in, so she cuts off part of her heel so that she can fit into the glass slipper. And as she's riding off with the prince who's accepted her, the prince notices that she's leaving a trail of blood behind and then rejects her, and they go back to the house. And then the second sister comes, and she cuts off one of her toes so that her foot will fit into the glass slipper. And again, the prince doesn't see this and goes riding off with her because her foot fits, but then sees the trail of blood that she is leaving behind and so returns to the house yet a third time and finds at last Ella in the cinders, Cinderella, whose foot fits the shoe without her distorting herself. Don't cut yourself. Don't take drugs that you don't need. See if you can find a way to live that uses your unique abilities. Green blessings. Well, it's just about time for Stacey Lyons, isn't it?
It is. She's not here yet, but she has another minute to arrive here.
She does indeed have another minute to arrive. And I'm wondering if this is the woman that I heard singing at, where was it? I think she was singing at the Midwest Women's Herbal Conference. And because she, you know, when I was collecting terms for it down there, she used a term that I had not heard anybody else use. It's a pretty obvious term, and that's hoo-hoo. So it made me, as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, I wonder if that's the woman that I heard singing that song about her hoo-hoo. Now, if that, dear listeners, has not gotten your attention, I don't know what will. Do we have Stacey with us yet?
Not quite yet.
Not quite yet. Well, do we have another question then? Let's see if we can do a short question.
Yes. So I am interested in learning about herbal medicine as a healing practice for me and to give to others. I just moved to Shokan after 38 years in New York City. Are you close by? Are you teaching? Where to start? Thank you.
I am close by to Shokan and Ashokan. I'm in the Woodstock area. And the place to start is wherever you are most attracted. You know, we all are dependent on plants. We eat plants. We clothe ourselves in plants. We sit on plants. We do all kinds of things with plants. And so I often say that the place to start is just by acknowledging that and being grateful for that. And you probably use herbs already in your cooking. Perhaps one of those herbs is attractive to you and you want to start looking at information for that herb. I have a general correspondence course which covers 52 different herbs, and that's called the ABC of herbalism. Not only does it cover 52 different herbs, but it covers over a dozen different common health problems and the ways that I would deal with it. So that's certainly one possibility, is to take my ABC of herbalism class, and it's one that you start at any time, and there's no time limit. You can work on it for the rest of your life if you want to. One of the ways that I started herbal medicine was I got a blank book, and as I met plants, I wrote them in my book. I tried to keep them roughly alphabetical, but you can see there's some pretty funny things going in and on and around in that book. I got a field guide, and I went outside and started identifying things, then tried to figure out how to use them. And, wow, you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s when I was doing that, there was not very much information. So in a way, your difficulty will be the opposite of mine, which was not being able to find out much, and you'll find out far too much about any plant that you want to look into. I start teaching again in April, and I hope you'll come and visit my website, susanweed.com, and my next year's schedule is posted. You might also want to consider being a Live Out Apprentice. Live Out Apprentices come to every single one of my one-day classes over a period of a year, although you have 2 years to complete that, so that if you miss one year, you can come the next year to it, as well as special perks and things that happen with the Live Out Apprenticism, private time here, as well as those classes. So, again, check that out at my website. And you may also want to get some of my books at the Wise Woman Bookshop. You can find all of my books. My big green book, Healing Wise, is a wonderful place to start because it talks about the three traditions of healing and helps ground you in herbal medicine. I could go on and on about different things that
yes,
you can do.
Yes, Stacy has arrived.
Probably have our Stacy here now, and so can go forward with her. Stacy, a lion's path to a healthy hoo-hoo has been a lifelong journey. She has always had a passion for health and wellness, and she had a light bulb moment, the kind you hear about, but it really happens in real life. No, it's true. The light smacked her alongside the head after three coincidental conversations in 1 week of September. And Stacy is grateful for the opportunity to help women. Welcome to the show, Stacy Lyons.
Hi, Susan. Nice to be here.
Nice to be here. So are you the woman who sang, Dr. Bronner's makes you hoo-hoo tingle? Girls, you know what I mean. Was that you?
No, it wasn't me, but isn't that just great? You know, who wants a peppermint patty in your panties?
Right?
I think that's how the rest of the song went, anyhow.
Something like that, right?
Yeah. And if you've ever used Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap, you know what I'm talking about.
You know what she means. Makes your hoo-hoo tingle. Ooh. Well, we started out the show. I don't know if you had a chance to listen. We started out the show. The very first caller has chronic gardnerella. Or bacterial vaginosis.
That's a tough one.
It really is, huh?
It is. And, you know, as much as I would love to say my products are, you know, awesome, they're great, I come at this whole thing with a real holistic understanding that you've kind of got to work with your body. No soap or, you know, I guess unless you're talking something that your doctor has prescribed is going to solve anything. So, you know, to solve some of these problems, I think you really are down the right path, looking at herbs and looking at your diet and you know, and what you're doing with your body holistically.
Are there chemicals or things that you found that women use it in their private areas that are problematic?
Yeah, and it's funny because I, you know, tend to go as natural as possible. I'm a big believer, which is funny because I actually started this company to make money, but one of my favorite marketing sayings is, you know, if you want to wash with water, that's what you should be washing with. If you want something more than water, here's a great alternative. So, yeah, I've heard stories of women trying to use, you know, lavender extracts and essential oils, which can be extremely irritating to the delicate skin, especially of the vagina.
Yes, it always really brings tears to my eyes when I hear of women applying essential oils.
Yeah, now some of my products have a great extract in them, and there are certain extracts that are wonderful for that area, but I highly recommend buying them in a solution like mine where the percentages are appropriate for that area. But one of the extracts that we love to put in all of our products is pomegranate extract. It is a natural antifungal, and it is great at keeping those bad bacteria at bay.
The yellow herbs are frequently used because they contain compounds that are very powerfully antifungal. Do you use those as well?
Which herbs?
Yellow herbs like golden seal, coptis, Oregon grape, berberis.
You know, I don't use any of those. I worked with both a naturopathic and a gynecologist on coming up with our formula. We actually ended up hiring a natural formulation chemist. And so we had to walk a really fine line of what was the least irritating, what was the most general, gentle, all-purpose cleanser we could use that wouldn't bother anyone. And so many people have certain allergies that we really had to remove a lot of those yellow herbs, of some of the botanicals out there that are known to cause some problems.
Gee, I have never heard of any of those herbs causing any problems.
Well, again,
The essential oils cause problems across the board. So I got to say that a gentle rinse of the vaginal area with one of those yellow herbs, to my mind, would cause far less side effects or problems than any dilution of essential oil.
Yes, I agree. And then another thing, Susan, that I really try and instill in women is that you have really two parts and two pieces down there that need to be treated very separately. The vulva, a.k.a. all of the outside bits, is skin.
Uh-huh.
It's epidermal tissue. So it's good to go with a gentle cleanser. The vagina is just like the inside of your nose, as it's a mucosal tissue. So very different tissue. So
yeah.
I'm really, really a strong advocate of trying to tell people, and if I have to do with a little humor, I will, that the vagina is a self-cleaning oven and to leave it alone. We're only down there. We're only down there to wash
the
vulva.
So wash the vulva, but not the vagina.
Exactly, and I know this is going to sound kind of funny, but if you can almost make a peace sign, you know, between your index finger and your pointer, you know, wash like that. You're just going to get the outside bits where the sebaceous glands are going to produce, you know, sweat and odor, but you're going to let the vagina clean itself. Do not go in there. Do not clean it. Do not touch it. It really knows what it needs to do.
Oh, what a beautiful message, Stacy. Thank you so much. That's so important. You know, because douching still exists. Goodness, I would have thought by now that we would have managed to get rid of it, but it persists. And it actually has been found to increase the likelihood of vaginal infections.
And in fact, I'm actually in the process of writing a blog post on that very subject. So it's funny that you mentioned that, Susan. So I've been doing a lot of researching, and I can't come up with one good reason why women should douche. There's nothing about it. Even if it's, and people look at me or they say to me, oh, well, what about just a real mild vinegar wash, you know, douche? No, no, and no.
Yeah. In my book down there, I come out very strongly against douching, and I suggest that instead you could do a sitz bath.
Mm-hmm.
Which means merely that you sit in whatever it is. Now, if you want to do your Kegels while you're doing that, you probably can get some of that solution up inside the vagina, but only the amount that your own body can take up.
That's a good multitasking right there.
Right there, right? But no to douching. I remember my mom used to douche, and she would always say that she'd like to douche after she was done menstruating because she felt that it would wash the rest of the blood out.
So I had someone send me an old advertisement, and it was just the advertisement, so I don't know what year it was, but we're guessing it was from about the 40s. Believe it or not, it is an ad for Lysol douching.
Yes.
So you wonder where these behaviors started and, you know, then were carried on. And this is kind of a taboo subject, let's face it. So, you know, we're not out there meeting, you know, a lot of women and talking about, well, what do you do, you know, best practices isn't really a common, you know, conversational piece. So you're kind of inheriting a lot of this knowledge, you know, from mother and grandmother. And so these tales of douching being okay, you know, are continued on to this day, which we just need to stop.
Which we just need to stop, to get the word out to women that sprays, hygiene sprays, douches, these kinds of things, actually have the reverse effect of what we would hope for.
Exactly. And then anything that's got a fragrance or a floral, especially if you look at the back of any stuff and it just uses the word fragrance, be very, very aware that the word fragrance can encompass hundreds of chemicals. And some of those chemicals can be endocrine disruptors. And endocrine disruptors are the things that mess with our hormones.
All essential oils are endocrine disruptors.
Yes.
That's why I suggest that women don't ever use products that contain essential oils in any dilution of any kind, and especially not near any kind of sensitive tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we know, but that's kind of hard sometimes to put into other people's minds, is that there is a connection between the vagina and the vulva, and that is that there are fluids in the vagina which come out and then contact the vulva. And there should be a thriving community of different things in the vagina, in which case what's going to be coming to the vulva is going to be clear or slightly white, slippery or tacky, but it's not going to be irritating in any way at all. But if our community starts to have a hard time, then what's coming out of the vagina and making contact with the vulva is going to be irritating to the vulva. And I have found that some women douche or scrub because they feel that they can change what's going on by doing that, but we know that that isn't true.
Correct. What the vagina really is all about, in very general terms, is like a healthy cup of yogurt. It's made up of approximately 50 strands of lactobacilli, and those are good bacteria. What happens when a woman gets in there and scrub-a-dub-dub is they're removing that protective lactobacilli layer. And they're messing with the pH. The pH is on the acidic scale, and the vagina is acidic because an acidic environment inhibits the overgrowth of bad bacteria. So what happens is women all of a sudden they get a knee-jerk reaction, like, oh, I've got a goop, I've got a smell, I've got something going on, I better get in there and scrub. they wash away and scrub away this protective layer, which henceforth leads to more overgrowth, which then leads to more side effects.
Yeah.
So the big key is to leave it alone and let your body come into balance.
I was very surprised to find that there is no study that has ever shown that yogurt can help improve the balance, and yet every time I ask a group of women, there's like a really unanimous show of hands from women saying that yogurt is one of the things that helps their vaginal balance more than anything else. What has been your experience?
Well, you know, there's a couple different schools on that one. I've had a naturopathic tell me, I'm smiling because she actually told me a horrible story about when she told someone to use yogurt and they went ahead and used blueberry yogurt, but I won't go there with that story. But she prescribed, you know, just straight, you know, non-sugared, plain yogurt, and that you can actually, you know, introduce that to the vagina. A lot of studies that I've looked at are about a probiotic that you can take orally, and that it's a certain set of strands of lactobacillia that pass the blood barrier. So you can take it through your mouth, but it's going to pass into the vagina and repopulate the vagina with the healthy, the actual strain is called RC14, and you'll actually see it on the back of bottles in the health food stores as a woman's support or a vulvo-vaginal support, and there's certain strands that can actually pass the blood barrier and enter the vagina that way.
Wow. That is pretty amazing.
I know. Pretty smart scientists to figure that one out.
Pretty smart body, too. It can do that for us. This is Susan Wheat talking with Stacey Lyons here on Women's Radio. And Stacey is the Healthy Hoo-Hoo Woman. That's where you'll find her, www.healthyhoohoo. That's HOOHOO.com. And you can find lots of fun things there at Stacey Lyons' website, healthyhoohoo.com. So you said that you got hit, you got smacked on the side of the head after three coincidental conversations. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. I mean, I'll be truthfully honest. My background is not in women's healthcare. I'm a mountain girl. I ski. I was a marketer by profession. And so I wasn't one of these people that you would just naturally come to and talk about these things. But in 1 week of my life, during a rather transitional time in my life, which I'll also frame up as I was actually very open in my life to change, I had a conversation with my roommate from college on a Monday, and she had just told me that she had had a double breast mastectomy. And we had a very intimate, you know, college girlfriend talk about her cancer, and she told me that they had found parabens in her breast tissue biopsy. So I'd never heard of the word paraben, so I had to figure out what that was. And of course, you know, then you're asking, you know, personal questions, what do you do differently? So she's telling me that she was using all paraben-free health and beauty products. Shoot ahead a couple more days later, and a gal that I worked with confided in me, you know, that she had a funny smell going on down there. And I said, well, you know, I think you're supposed to just leave it alone. She's like, well, I don't know what to wash with. What should I wash with? Well, being a fixer friend, I get on the internet and I start doing a little research, and so I had some ideas. Now Scooter had two more days. It was a Friday, and I actually had my annual appointment with my gynecologist, so I posed the question to her, and she's like, you know, there's just not a lot of good, you know, alternatives out there for women who want to wash with water. And she goes, and boy, do we need it. And I said, well, why? She goes, oh, we are in the perfect storm, and these are her words. And I said, what do you mean, perfect storm? And she said, well, you know, I got into this business to deliver babies, but all I'm seeing is women in here with vulval vaginal issues, vaginitis. And I said, well, why is that? She said, well, number one, we're eating a high-sugar processed food diet. Number two, we're over-cleaning. We're too clean of a society. And number three, we're really wearing some bad underwear, a.k.a.
Ooh, yeah.
Those polyester thongs, they are not good. And so she blamed it, and she said, in 20 years, she's seen this, you know, all the numbers of mild vaginal irritation and the bacterial disruptions escalate. And she thought it was because of those three reasons. So here I am in 1 week having these three very distinct conversations. I walk across the street to a Whole Foods market, and I go in there with my big girl words, and I said, do you have, and I think I even called it paraben-free, you know, fragrance-free, really gentle feminine wash. And the sweet gal there said, no, but we need one. And right there in aisle number 7 on a Friday afternoon, I had my light bulb moment.
It was you.
That was it. I had the light bulb moment. Like, if no one's going to do this, and the only thing on the market, you know, that's pH balance is laden with all of these harsh chemicals, you know, someone's got to provide a safer alternative.
Yay, for safer alternatives for us.
Yes.
So there was something in that story that you said you wanted to come back to.
Oh, I think it was just the paraben talk about the to explain what a paraben was, that it's a preservative that's used in a lot of health and beauty products. And if you're in your shower and you turn your shampoo bottle over, you'll see it usually in the last few ingredients. And it usually has a prefix on it. So it will say methyl paraben, isoparaben. There's different types of them. In a recent study done in the UK, I think actually I say recent, it was like a year and a half ago, in a set number of studies on the cancer biopsies of the cancer tissue, 99% of these biopsies came back with parabens in them.
I would guess that parabens are oil-soluble chemicals. And oil-soluble chemicals tend to accumulate in fatty tissue.
Yes, and we've got a lot of adipose tissue around our breast.
Tissue. So I'm unclear as to whether you're inferring that there is some causal link between parabens and breast cancer, or whether you understand that no causal link can be inferred from this information.
Oh, it's not my words. It's just one of those, you know, heads up, make your own decisions, look at the information that's out there. And a chemist friend of mine said, you know, parabens aren't necessarily, you know, the evil guy that people make them out to be. What's happening, however, is that women are applying so many more products on a daily basis that it could be our daily exposure that's leading to the storage in the fat cells of this chemical.
In general, all oil-soluble chemicals are stored because they cannot be removed from the body. So all exposure to fat-soluble chemicals is cumulative exposure. However, so far as I know, and our knowledge is quite incomplete, there is no causal link between parabens and cancer. Just as we know that 100% of babies born in the United States have triclosan, the antibacterial stuff in your hand wash, in their cord blood. But we don't at this point know whether or not having triclosan in your blood from the moment of conception on is a health risk. We think it is because we do know that triclosan is banned in Europe because it causes cancer. So I would be actually far more concerned about women washing their hands with antibacterial soaps than using a cosmetic or a cleanser with paraben in it. I mean, triclosan is a known and present health risk, and yet it is widely used in our environment as an antibacterial and so there, you know, these things, yes, they're called persistent organic pollutants because they persist in our bodies. And I am so glad that you have products that are paraben free.
Sure, and it's just again
it's
just to have that option.
Everything helps, gives us more options, exactly. And parabens are basically preservatives.
Yes, and they do a very good job at that.
Exactly. And preservatives are there not for the customer, but for the product. In other words, a preservative is not put in a product because it will make the customer healthier. It's put in the product to make the product last, so that it has a long shelf life. So the paraben is not being used to promote any health, any direct human health effect. It's being used for the, basically, for the good of the manufacturer.
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, we have come to the last minute of our show here at Women's Radio. You've been listening to Susan Weed and Stacey Lyons talk about hoo-hoos and peppermint patties in your panties and bad undies and 50 different kinds of lactobacillus in your vagina and the difference between the vagina and the vulva. Check out Stacey Lyons at www.healthyhoohoo, that's H-O-O-H-O-O, healthyhoohoo.com, and you will be surprised and thrilled and ever so glad that you did. So for the last 60 seconds here on our show, Stacey Lyons, what would you like to leave women thinking about?
You know, I would just like to give some of the women a little more, you know, a little more information about optimal hygiene. You know, you talked about douching. I'm going to add limit your bubble bath, limit your sugar intake, be careful of petroleum jelly, stay away from talcum powder. That's another one of those kind of grandma handed down tips that we need to avoid. And as I said before, limit your use of thongs. Be careful of river washing. Don't forget, the vagina is a self-cleaning oven.
Stacey Lyons, that is really good advice. Thank you for joining me, Susan Weed, here on Women's Radio. And thank you for helping me reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. You know, those really ancient ones, the ones who didn't douche or use powder or any kind of parabens at all. It's been wonderful. Thanks so much, Stacey. May you thrive, and thanks for your commitment to women and women's well-being. Green blessings, everybody, until we meet again here at Women's Radio and here at Susan Weed's Blog Talk Show.